It's 8:30 now. It's time for the Law Report with Damien Carrick. Damien, good morning.
Good morning, Fran.
And Damien, today you have the Chief Justice of a jurisdiction where judges are usually bilingual.
Yes, Beverly McLaughlin, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Canada, who's currently here in Australia. The importance placed on looking after the language needs of Canada's French speakers is just one of the differences between Canada and Australia. There are similarities. We're both huge, sparsely populated, resource-rich federations who share strong legal traditions inherited from the Brits. We certainly enjoy many of the same strengths and face many of the same challenges. Chief Justice, welcome to Australia.
Wonderful to be here.
Wonderful to have you. You are, of course, here to speak at a conference looking back at the decade since 9/11 and the enormous legal challenges that have arisen as a result. What do you see as the challenges facing post-9/11 democracies, countries like Canada and Australia?
Well, the big challenge, it seems to me, is to recognise, A, that terrorism is an ongoing thing. It seems to me, anyway, that we are going to have to deal with it on a permanent basis. And secondly, that being the case, to find a way that we can combat terrorism and maintain security for society while maintaining our values and the rule of law. And this is, to me, an imperative thing to do, because we don't want to lose the things we value most in our society. We don't want to become undemocratic, illegal society simply because we're terrified. We have to keep our emphasis on rights and our values. But at the same time, we have to fight terrorism. So the question is, how do we do this?
You describe it in your speech as a trade-off between individual liberty and collective security.
There is some trade-off, but, you know, I don't think it's an either-or proposition. I think that would be unpalatable to people in our countries, in our free democracies. You have to fight terrorism and keep your country safe, but you also have to, in the process, maintain those fundamental values on which democracy is based. So it's not either-or. We have to find a way to do both.
A little later, we might come back to some of the decisions that you speak about in your speech, which have been heard by the Supreme Court of Canada. Of course, this is absolutely a shared challenge by all countries. I'd now like to talk about some of the similarities and differences between our two countries. One of the differences between the High Court of Australia and the US Supreme Court, on the one hand, and the Supreme Court of Canada on the other, is that your court webcasts and broadcasts all its hearings.
The Supreme Court of Canada watched the proceedings unfold as the highest court in the land sets out on a precedent-setting pilgrimage to equity. It's a journey to the last stop in the long pursuit of justice. Supreme Court hearings. See them on CPAC.
I've loved what I've seen on the website. Is there a big audience for such broadcasts, and why do you do it?
I'm not sure whether there's a big audience, but there is a real audience. I meet people who say they follow it more or less regularly, and I meet a lot of people who say they happen to have tuned in at 3 a.m. when they were having an insomniac moment. We often don't get prime time billing on the television rebroadcast. On the webcasting, I think there's quite a bit of uptake. For example, in law schools, law students can tune right in and see what's happening at the Supreme Court of Canada at that moment. And if there is interest in cases, could be of great pedagogical interest. So I think it's basically been a very positive experience for our court.
Merci. Vous pouvez vous asseoir. Tommy Bouchard Lebrun contre Sa Majesté la Reine, Véronique Robert et Roland Roy.
Madame la juge en chef, messieurs les juges, mesdames les juges, vous avez lu bien sûr la trame factuelle dans le dossier qui nous occupe.
Now, of course, a huge difference between Canada and Australia is that Canada is a bilingual nation. And when I was looking at those court broadcasts, there were, of course, depending on the case, sometimes the court proceedings were in English and sometimes they were in French. Are all the judges on the Supreme Court of Canada bilingual?
Well, they all have some French. Now, most of us can hear cases in either language, ask questions in either language. One of our justices prefers to use the interpreters, which there's a simultaneous interpretation during all the hearings. So it can vary, although the litigants have the right to use whatever language they want, and there is simultaneous translation so that everybody in the courtroom can understand exactly what's going on.
Now, I understand that last year Canada passed a law requiring all chief justices from here on in to be bilingual. Was that move controversial?
Well, actually, the law has not been passed, and it died on the order paper before our last election. So there's no such law in effect. The draft bill did raise a lot of debate, provoke a lot of debate, and there were two very definite views put forward. The one view was that since the Supreme Court of Canada is the highest court, the important institution in the country, country's bilingual, everybody, regardless of whether their first language is French or English, ought to be confident that every judge can understand them directly. This was the argument put for the bill and the requirement that all justices, not just the Chief Justice, be bilingual. Against it was the fact that it would very much lessen or decrease the pool of available justices for the Supreme Court of Canada, particularly in some parts of the country where the potential candidates, be they judges on the courts of appeal or practitioners in the legal practice, might not be bilingual. So there was quite a debate on that.
And I don't suppose you'd want to offer your opinion here?
I have never offered my opinion on this. I take the position, whether it's here or in Canada, that under our constitution, it is for the government, prime minister and his cabinet, to appoint justices to the Supreme Court of Canada. And how they do that is their constitutional business. And so I have not commented on it. I have said, though, that whatever the decision may ultimately be, and at the present, when it's not an absolute requirement, our court will continue to offer services and function in both languages, as is, of course, required.
Mm. Speaking of the appointment of judges, Canada and Australia are both federations, and they are both giant landmasses. But our two countries respond to those shared attributes very, very differently. In Canada, the appointments to the Supreme Court, they must come from across the country. I understand that there's a formula to ensure that judges are appointed from across the country. Can you tell me about that formula?
Well, by law, three of the judges of the nine have to come from Quebec. And that is justified by the fact that Quebec has a different civil law. They have the civil code, which is like the legal systems in continental Europe, France, for example. And they prize that very greatly as part of their heritage. So in order to protect the proper interpretation of civil code and also the linguistic concerns of people from that province where the majority speak French, I think the law has been passed that in the Supreme Court Act, these three of the nine judges have to come from Quebec. Now, other than that, there's no law in the books, but there is a custom, which could be violated and has occasionally been, that one of the judges comes from our maritime provinces in the east, that three come from Ontario, that one come from the prairies and one come from British Columbia. So this regional component is quite important in appointing judges. Right now, we have two judges from Ontario who have announced they will be leaving the court. So there's a search for new judges in Ontario.
I understand that there is no equivalent national court that has this kind of geographic diversity built into its foundations. Is that your understanding as well?
I can't really comment on that. It used to be the case, I think, in the United States Supreme Court in the beginning, judges came from different circuits, which gave that a regional character, but that has passed and is no longer the case there. So you may well be right.
I've got to tell you, to Australian ears, this is absolutely remarkable. In Australia, since the foundation of our High Court at the beginning of the 20th century, there have been more appointments from New South Wales than all the other states and territories combined. And indeed, there has never in the history of the court been a judge from either Tasmania or South Australia, and I can tell you that that's a sore point. At one point a few years ago, I think something like 5 out of 7 High Court justices were from the Sydney Bar. And I know it's impolitic to ask you what your views might be of our system, but do you think Canadians would be happy if half the judges throughout the Supreme Court of Canada's history were all from Ontario?
I wouldn't dare venture into Australian politics on this point, but I think every country evolves its own way of governing, and every federation has to evolve its own ways of looking after the regions. So one of the things is that we have traditionally, up to this time, it could change, taken a regional approach. Region is one factor in appointing Supreme Court judges, and that's simply the way our country has evolved. Other countries might find different ways of making sure that regional concerns are represented. But for us, that seems to be the way it has evolved. And I actually am very comfortable with it. I think it gives the court a legitimacy right across the country.
Let's talk about that legitimacy. Is it important? Is the regional diversity important because it provides a diversity of perspectives on the court? Or is it because of the message it sends out to the nation, this is your court, this is everybody's court? Or is it both?
It's both. I think it's both. I think we really welcome the perspectives we get. You know, a judge from Quebec may say, well, you know, this is the way people in Quebec might look at this kind of problem, or from the Maritimes, or from the West. They might have a better sense of the history of how different issues have developed in those parts of the country because of their ties. And they bring that to the table in the deliberation and discussion. But equally, if not more important, is the fact that the public feels a sense of ownership in the institution, which is so important to its legitimacy.
Speaking of diversity, 4 out of 9 of the justices on the Supreme Court of Canada are women, and you are the first female Chief Justice of Canada. Are you proud of your achievement and proud of the gender diversity on the Supreme Court of Canada's bench?
Well, I'm proud and gratified at both. I'm proud of my country for making this, early on, as these things go, a very important priority. After all, 51% of the population are women. And it's important also that that 51% see, we were talking about diversity in terms of regions and ownership and the feeling of ownership. It's important to women that they feel that they are represented on the court. And I think, again, women bring different perspectives sometimes, certainly important perspectives.
I believe that many years ago when you were presiding over a family court case, you had a bit of a eureka moment when it dawned on you the importance of having gender
yes.
diversity in courtrooms. Could you yeah. tell me about that moment?
Yeah. Well, I was a trial judge, and it was a slow afternoon, and I was assigned to a matrimonial case, family case, and very simple, it seemed to me. Husband and wife were divorcing, and they had settled all the issues except for the property. They had a townhouse and a little bit of other property. So the wife was there, represented by female counsel. The court clerk was female. The court reporter was female. And I was female. And the husband was there all alone, representing himself. So we heard the wife's case. And then I turned to the husband and I said, well, now it's your turn. I'd like to have your story. And he didn't seem to be able to rise to his feet. So I tried to encourage him. I said, you know, I really need to hear your side of the story before I can resolve this dispute. It's not complicated. You just need to tell me what you feel about these issues. And finally, he got to his feet. And I had assumed that he was feeling nervous because he didn't have a lawyer. But to my surprise, he said, with a tone of umbrage in his voice, frankly, Your Honor, I feel a little outnumbered. And I assured him that the fact that he was a man would not be held against him, and that in the end he did tell his story and we resolved the case, got the property settled. I went home that night and I reflected on it, and I thought, how many times have women in history stood up before a court, if they could ever get that far, and felt a little outnumbered? And that was a eureka moment. I mean, I really then understood how important it was that we have women represented on the bench.
Hmm. We're speaking about geography, we're speaking about gender in terms of the appointment of judges. In Australia, and traditionally in Canada, judges are appointed by government with input from the legal profession, and those appointments those appointment decisions are made behind closed doors, whereas in the USA we have those very high-profile Senate committees where senators can grill and indeed veto a candidate. I believe that in recent times in Canada there have been US-style parliamentary committees which have questioned judicial nominees. In particular, I think it was Marshall Rothstein. Can I put to you a quote that you made, some words that you said before these changes were brought in? I found a quote which says, "I think there's a simple trade-off here. The more you question candidates on the merits of cases, the more you are going to impair the appearance of impartiality. Judges who are grilled about their leanings on various issues will feel obliged to rule on them in a manner that appears to be consistent," end quote. So it sounds like you're not super happy.
No, I agree. Well, I stand by that. I mean, it's all in the nature of the questioning. The questioning of Justice Marshall Rothstein did not go into how would you vote on this issue, that kind of
abortion,
question.
Gay marriage, guns.
And I think that's really inappropriate. That's really inappropriate. And you'll notice even in the United States in the Senate hearings, when they ask that kind of questions, the judges decline to answer generally, because a potential judge just can't do that. They would have to say in honesty, well, it's a question about guns, shall we say, gun control. Well, I would have, if the case comes before me, my job as a judge is to look at one side, to look at the other side, to listen to what everybody has to say, to reflect on it, and then make my decision. Here you are asking me to make a decision before I can even go through that process. So it just doesn't make sense, as well as the point I made that the perception and perhaps the reality of impartiality might be impaired. And everybody wants an impartial judge. When you go to court, you spend a lot of time and perhaps money getting there. The reason you're there is that you want somebody who has not already made up their mind. And so I think we have to preserve that judicial impartiality and judicial independence. If there are to be hearings, which we have in our country, then those hearings have to be structured in a way that respects that.
And you're comfortable with the way they are evolving?
Well, it's early days. We've had one. It went well. So I think I'll have to content myself with that. I can't foresee the future.
Justice Rothstein, if you would like to proceed at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Minister. Ladies and gentlemen, there's a lot of interest in this new process, and there are a lot of people here, and the media are here. Very often when I give a presentation at a conference, it is toward the end of the day when people are filing out and not many people are left in the room.
You're listening to The Law Report on ABC Radio, National Radio Australia and ABC News Radio. Today, a conversation with Chief Justice Beverley McLaughlin, the Chief Justice of Canada, who's currently in Australia. Chief Justice, both our countries are federations, but I think it's widely regarded that Canada's federation is in many ways, for better or worse, a lot more robust than Australia's. And there are a number of reasons why that might be. One of them might actually be the construction of our respective constitutions. Section 51 of our constitution spells out the powers of the federal government. There's no corresponding list of powers for our states. And over the years, I think everyone in Australia acknowledges that the way those powers have been interpreted have been in an expansionist way. Now, I understand that in the Canadian constitution, there are two lists of powers. You've got Section 91, which lists the powers of the federal government, and Section 92, which lists a corresponding list of provincial powers.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Do you think that these two separate lists mean that Canadian courts have more to work with than their Australian or indeed US colleagues when deciding cases of where federal powers begin and where they end?
Well, they certainly give us a lot to work with. We have many debates before us, many issues, and we have a few right now on what we call division of powers. And what happens when you have two lists, as we do, is that there is overlap sometimes between them. For example, the provinces have property and civil rights, but the federal government has federal corporations, competition, shipping might be the better example. Shipping involves property and civil rights. So then these questions come before the courts. Is it federal? Is it provincial? And this has been, of course, been going on since 1867 when our country was formed, our federation was formed, and it continues to go on.
The High Court of Australia is widely regarded as Canberra's friend. It's been regarded as having interpreted the powers of the Commonwealth in a broad and growing way. Is the Supreme Court of Canada regarded as Ottawa's friend?
Oh, I don't think you could say that. I think that perhaps the best statement of this is in our case called the secession reference, which was on the question of whether a province can unilaterally secede from the federation. And one of the foundational principles the court referred to in that case was the principle of federalism, which would mean that there has to be a balance maintained between the powers of the provinces and the federal power, and that one level of government cannot trench too deeply on the other level of government. So this balance is fundamental to the way we approach the question, and I hope that is the way our court is perceived, not as a friend necessarily of the federal or the provincial, but maintaining that balance.
Well, presumably there you're talking about a case involving Quebec, and of course Canada in many ways is a much more fragile political entity than Australia. I mean, one member of the family, Quebec, regularly talks about divorce. Mm-hmm. I wonder, does that mean that the federal contract can never be taken for granted, either politically or indeed legally? And that does impact mm-hmm. on everything we've been talking about so far today.
I agree that the federal contract can never be taken for granted. And I don't think it's just a question of Quebec. For example, in each region of Canada has its very deep sense of itself and its importance and its role in the federation. And that has to be respected at all times. And like an ongoing marriage, you take the other partner or partner, in this case, partners, for granted at your peril. It is constantly a matter of approaching each issue that arises with respect.
Another difference between our two countries is that Canada, in 1982, adopted a Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Australia is now almost alone in the world in not having a Bill of Rights or a Charter of Rights, mm-hmm. either at a constitutional level or at a legislative level. Mm-hmm. Do charter cases or charter arguments make up a substantial part of your court's workload, Chief Justice?
Quite a bit. Not as much now as in the years after the charter was adopted, shortly after 1982. But we still have a significant number of charter cases. Some of them arise in the context of the criminal law, rights of an accused person, principles of evidence and that sort of thing. Others arise in the context of the exercise of rights of free speech and other rights guaranteed by the Charter, equality rights and so on. So this is a continuing source of litigation, and many of the cases before us involve these kind of issues.
Well, many of those cases have been very controversial. I mean, I know there was a case involving a tobacco company, I think it was RJR McDonald, and it was where a ban on cigarette advertising and unattributed health warnings was deemed to contravene, as I understand it, the right to freedom of expression. And and I know that cases like this one are certainly used by Australians who are skeptical mm-hmm. about us adopting a charter or a Bill of Rights?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, RJR McDonald ruled out some extreme practices on control, but I like to assure your listeners that warnings on tobacco packages and other such things are alive and well in Canada, and we're not affected by that. I think in the charter, too, rights are not absolute, and we have Section 1 of the Charter, which introduces proportionality, and really just says when the government wants to limit a right, be it free speech or whatever right, they have to justify doing it. And the problem, what RJR McDonald came down to, was that the government couldn't justify, at least in the opinion of the majority, all of the things they were trying to do. They could justify a lot of it. So, you know, charter critics will pounce on something like this and say, well, it just shows you how terrible it is. You can't put warnings on cigarette packages. Not the case. I mean, when you look at the actual decisions, you see that the balance is very carefully pondered. And a charter does not prevent a government from limiting rights. What it does prevent is a government from limiting rights and not having to justify those limits.
The argument is put, though, that cases like that one involve, you know, very complex issues of public policy, health policy, mm-hmm. and that those are best left to government rather than to courts, who are not well placed to work yeah. out the best public policy outcomes.
Our court has said that, and it's in our jurisprudence, and therefore we accord on these issues of social, economic importance, we say and we do accord a high level of deference to government. Governments can look at all the options, they can hear from the voters, they can hear from the experts, they can tailor detailed solutions, and it's the duty of the courts to give deference to that and to recognize that superior position. But when in the few cases, if it happens, and it does happen sometimes, governments go too far without justification, a citizen is entitled to come and say, they can't justify this, and they can come before the courts and do that.
Well, coming back full circle to where we began our discussion, cases involving terrorist suspects, your court had to decide, in a case, forgive my pronunciation, Shakawi?
Shakawi, we call it, yeah.
Did that involve charter arguments?
Yes, it involved arguments on liberty. The charter guarantees freedom of liberty. At issue was a provision of the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act, which allowed landed immigrants who were suspected of terrorist connections to be detained indefinitely. And the statute set up provision for review in the federal courts. Problem was that there was, because of the sensitive nature of this kind of information, a lot of it happened in secret. The trials or the review process was in secret. So the challenge was to those secrecy provisions. And Shakawi was a detained person, and he said, how can I make a case that I should be released when I can't even see the material on which I have been detained? He was not allowed to see the documents or who the informants were or anything like that. So his lawyers said, we can't begin to contest this detention, therefore that infringes our liberty interest. So the court said, recognizing the need to keep this kind of information secret, which is important, absolutely critical in certain cases, there must be ways that the judge can at least get some sense of whether or not there's legitimacy to the founding claim. And although we could not uphold the act as it was, we suggested establishing independent counsel who could look at the people who were certified and trusted, could look at this, and if they had concerns, bring it forward. And the Act was amended in due course to do that.
Mm. Chief Justice McLaughlin, it's been a great pleasure speaking to you. Thank you very, very much for speaking to the Law Report.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it very much.
Beverly McLaughlin, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Canada, speaking about the protection of rights in the Great White North, and also speaking about Canadian federalism, which from an Australian perspective sounds both complicated and brittle, but also strangely robust. That's the Law Report for this week. I'm Damien Carrick. Thanks to producer Erica Vowles and technical producer Melissa May. Do visit our website at abc.net.au/rn/lawreport. There you can download audio, listen to the program online, read a transcript, or leave us a comment.